The Webcomic Beacon now presents First Issue, a brand new video series from the Webcast Beacon Network, in which three cartoonists from differing backgrounds take a look at the first issue of a comic and see if it succeeds or fails in doing what a first issue is supposed to do, and that is to make the reader want to get the next and following issues. You can check that out at firstissue.webcomicbeacon.com.
Now broadcasting the Webcomic Beacon.
How do I start the show? It's been so long.
Welcome to episode 216 of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com. We are a part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, and that's where you can find other great shows such as The Tropecast, Web Fiction World, and First Issue, our brand new our most recent show, web series where we review print comic books. And this is the Webcomic Beacon. I'm Fess of ArdraComic.com. And with me we have Mark Savory of AutumnLake.com.
Well, hello there.
Tanya doesn't seem to be here at the moment, but she might come in later. More news on that later in the show. But this week, we have a guest, Space Captain Steve from Blade Kitten. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How you doing?
I am doing wonderful, actually.
Ducky.
Yes. Quack. What does that even mean?
Just ducky.
It's not real, is it? It's all make-believe.
Walking around, pooping on the sidewalk, trying to bite little kids that have bread. I don't know. Do they have ducks in Australia?
We have ducks, yes.
Okay. I don't know.
They fly upside down, but we have ducks.
Oh, okay. So
we have swans too, and they're black.
Really?
Seriously? Yeah. West Australia has black swans.
Does everyone down there have like a mirror universe goatee?
Yes, like, but we shave them off. Tea?
Yes, we shave. Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, so Space Captain Steve, how did you come up with that name?
Came from when I was doing a comic about pirates, and I just for the hell of it had Grim Pirate Steve as the tagline. And then I did the next comic I did was a one page short sci-fi thing, and obviously it couldn't be Grim Pirate Steve again, so I just came up with Space Captain Steve, and it was so stupid I kept it.
And this goes out in your actual publications, don't they? Space Captain Steve,
Well, full name is Steve Stamatiadis, and Space Captain Steve is a lot easier for people to remember, and it's that right level of, like I said, stupid, silly, poking fun at myself, and I like that sense of fun about it, so I keep using it, and people seem to react well to it, so it's stuck.
Yeah.
In a good way.
We had a girl on the show, you know what, honestly, I don't remember her real name now, but she kind of goes by the name Butt Ovens. Or she just gets called Ovens, and basically that's what she's called now. So I called her Butts on the show because I thought that was funny. But
yeah, but yeah, names kind of stick like that.
Yeah, yeah. I know there's this other guy that has a podcast, and his name looks like Jersey. But apparently his name is Yeja.
Ah.
But everyone just calls him Jersey, so he kind of sticks with that. But after talking with him, I constantly remember Yeja because it's such a different name and it was such a point to make it up. But last names like yours, hang on, let me see if I can figure out how to pronounce it again. Steve... Stamatiadis?
Pretty close.
He got the S right?
Yeah. There's two ways of doing it. I do there's the the English-speaking one, we go, it's Stamatiadis. People can understand that. Then you have the proper Greek pronunciation, which is Stamatiadis, and people go, why? What? There's no D in it, and there's all these weird sounds in it. So you go with the English one, it's just pronounce out the syllables.
So we have Space Captain Steve here, and... And there's this okay. So, you mainly have the. Well, you're probably mostly known for your comic Blade Kitten, but it sounds like you did a comic before this that was a pirate comic that you had mentioned before.
I've done a bunch of stuff. I've done some print comics, and
you have
way back. I started doing stuff back in about 1988.
Wow!
Straight out of high school. I did this Australian anthology called Eureka, and I did a comic in that called Hedrax, which is very, very 80s sci-fi manga anime stuff with, giant robots and punk girls. And
so can anybody see any of your older stuff online anywhere, even if they're just covers?
No, I don't know. You can look around and search for some old comic. I think I've seen on some sites that auction off old, issues of comics, but it's so old. It's all pre-computer stuff. So it's only what people have grabbed. Even the cool thing is, I mean, issues are hard to find now. So I get people coming up to me at cons going, oh, I've got this issue. Can you sign? It's like, oh, wow, I haven't seen that in a long time. A lot of stuff I did even back in the early 90s just doesn't really exist anywhere, which is kind of cool. It keeps it mysterious.
What do you mean it doesn't really exist? You like lost all the originals or something, or?
No, I've got the originals, but they're not scanned. It's like, do you really want to spend days going through scanning A3 artwork where the lettering has fallen off because it was all cut and paste? The balloons all sort of...
Oh, wow.
You'd cut them out, stick them down, and letter set on it. Going, oh, man.
I remember that. Man.
Yeah. You'd sit there, like, finishing a page up. I think the page, and it's lettered. Oh, now I've got to put letter set on. And you sit there cutting it with an X-Acto knife and scraping away to get the shading.
Paste ups. Yeah.
Yeah, and I say word balloons will fall off. You'll lose your lettering and stuff. It's like, oh, I've got to fix all this stuff up. One day I plan on going and doing it, but it's like, I've got nothing else to do.
That's where you scan the comic.
Yeah, you take the finished comic and you scan it.
But the printed comic, it's never as good. It's like,
true.
You always lose detail in the print. And you look at your originals when they're kind of A3 size.
Right.
But you can just see the pen work and, oh, wow, I used to remember using a really fine crow quill pen. It's like, oh, yeah, no, don't bother now.
Wow. Well, still, it's kind of like, it would be really nice to have, like, some sort of secure, well, almost secure archive, which also you can kind of show off your old stuff, but also be like, here's a copy. It won't disappear, hopefully. You can still share it with other people if you can get to that point, of course. That'd be... Do you own all the rights to your old stuff, or was this sort of a work-for-hire sort of stuff, or...?
The old stuff, yeah.
So you could put it online if you wanted.
Yeah. What I've been thinking of doing, and I've toyed with the idea over the last couple of months, actually, is going through, rescanning it all, and... Now with print on demand, you can just go, I'll make a nice hardcover copy version for myself, for my archives.
Right.
And you go, look, when the apocalypse comes one day, whatever it is, it's like digital media will disappear. But, paper may last a few more years.
Mm-hmm.
So, but more than anything else, it's really cool just having a nice hardcover book
right.
of this stuff. And I've been doing a lot of that with the webcomics and stuff I've been doing, just to print it out. They don't sell particularly well, but... It's just nice having that book sitting by the computer. You go, I need to look at that page instead of actually going through a thumbnail browser trying to find the right page and load it up in Photoshop. It's like, just turn to the page. Oh, that's what I wanted. And it's quicker in some ways.
Yeah. And you might still have like a really dedicated fan out there that it just wants a copy. So that's the other beauty of print on demand. Where it's like, it's a little spendy, but at least you can get it,
Exactly.
So we're going to talk about Blade Kitten a little bit more, since that's like the big thing that you do right now. And you did have a little break. I don't know if you started Blade Kitten back up recently.
I have just started off a spin-off of Blade Kitten called Dirty Justice, which is... It's taking this... How do I explain it best?
Is it in the same universe? The same world?
Yeah, it's the same universe, the same era, like same time period in the same universe as Blade Kitten. But it's one of the bad guy characters from the game, and I'm just expanding her story and telling things from her side of sort of her point of view.
Okay.
And it's fun, because whereas Kit's a sort of bubbly, fun character, Justice is more of a bitch. And so so you've got this sort of nasty piece of work in some ways. You want to make her sort of be – show the good side of her as well.
Yeah, humanize her a little bit.
Yeah, and because of the world's – the Blade Kitten world actually began way before Blade Kitten.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got this huge universe to play in.
Yeah.
Like I've been just developing like factions and technology and just themes that I want to play with. So like, yeah, that wouldn't work for the kid story that I've been doing in Blade Kitten. But I could tell this other part of this story through Justice. And you can just, it's a sort of darker version of the same universe.
Okay.
Tonight I'm penciling a page where it's – I've done it before in a Blade Kitten comic. But now it's telling where Justice and Kit sort of interact and meet up for the first time.
Okay.
And now I'm telling it from Justice's point of view, and it all feels slightly different. Like Kit's a bit more rough around the edges, and yeah, you know, where so it's kind of the Rashomon of comics. That's what I'm doing.
Right, right. if you could, for our audience, give us a basic rundown of what Blade Kitten is.
Blade Kitten's a sci-fi anime style web comic about a bounty hunter called Kit Ballard, who's a Felion, which is like a half cat, half human, genetically engineered life form bounty hunter. And she runs around getting into more trouble than she expects. And the basic story sort of builds up. It starts off very fun and light. And as you get further into it, you discover there's a lot of machinations going on in the background that somehow involve Kit that she doesn't quite know about, and there's a bit of a mystery going on there that's bigger than the world she's on, even. and to help her out, she's got a sidekick called Skiffy, which is this queer little alien blob cat-like thing.
It's a Pokemon.
It's very much like a Pokemon. I'm not going to pretend. I was like, I wanted to do something really fun. I actually wanted to do something that was very ugly and alien-looking when you actually look at it, but still was cute. Yeah, how far could you go from something that looks normal and still actually make it kind of cuddly? And I think it worked. It's like if you look at it, it's like, ooh, those eyes are on either side of its head, and it's got those weird bulby arms and legs, and
those weird claws or whatever they are. They're just like,
yeah, it's all over the place, but people still find it incredibly cute.
Do you have any plushies made of it yet?
Everyone keeps asking, like, we did actually look. We sent some stuff off to this Chinese company, and they sent back a prototype, or photos of a prototype. And I told the person who got the photos back to me, never show me these ever again. They are that bad. It looked like someone had taken Skiffy, skinned him, run him over with a truck, and then said, look, okay, here's the final version. It was this horrible skinned malformed thing. Like, we're not doing with those people.
Crazy.
So that put me off doing anything with it for a while, but one day I'll get back to doing it, because it's, like I said, it's cute, and I always get asked, when's the plushies?
Yeah. I don't know. It might be one of those things that just might be too hard for a machine to make.
It's a blob. It's not that hard.
Well, you know, it's intricacies and... Anyway. So let's see here. We have, and one of the biggest things, which I don't remember how it caught my eye. I don't remember where I heard of Blade Kitten, if I heard of the game first or somebody just told me about it, but there is a video game based off of Blade Kitten. So you got to tell us about this. What happened? How did this come to be?
Okay. The story of how Blade Kitten came about originally was it was actually put together so I could do a game of it at some point. It was because I've developed games for like 20 years now, and all the time I've wanted to do the like a main a game sort of an anime feel, female lead character, sort of sci-fi universe, and for so long I always hear from publishers, oh, you can't do a game with a female lead character, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Yeah. Really?
So what I thought is like, look, I'll put the whole world together because I've got this universe I've been creating for ages, and I'll come up with a cool character that I like and sort of all the stuff that I wanted to have in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started off to sort of like, well, the best way to show that off is to do a graphic novel. It's like in Hollywood, we'll look at graphic novels or comics and go, all right, we'll take this property and we'll make a movie out of it. We've got all the acts there. We can see how it all fits together.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big storyboard. It's like, okay, well, let's try that for games. And I was working on it in the background for like, oh, good 6 or 7 years while doing games like Tiger, Tasmania, and Tiger. And I had just worked on Star Wars Force Unleashed. We did our company did the Wii version, the PS2 and the PSP versions of that. So I just done a big Star Wars game. And I had a real feeling for putting all this world together. And I thought, well, look, I could go work on the sequel. Or maybe now after we've done this big Star Wars game, it's like, maybe I should spend some time working on my own thing. So to cut a long story short, because I actually have a video game development company, it's like, okay, well, look, we're going to make this game now. So as opposed to going, trying to shop it around like you do normally, and all that time I'd spent doing the comic and stuff, it's like, oh, well, I'm just going to make it. So I didn't have to shop around. So it was kind of a weird thing. It's like, but all this effort to put it together, to shop it to other people, and in the end, I just went ahead and made it myself. Sometimes you just got to do that. Sometimes you go, look, we've got the money, we've got the people, we've got the talent, the experience. You know, we spent all this time just doing a big license for someone else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Star Wars is fun. I had a great time working on it, even though it was really hard work. It's like, I want to work on a smaller project, get a small team together, work on my own IP again. So I just made Blakin. And then we, ironically, we were going to publish it ourselves. And as soon as we took it to the Game Developers Conference and started showing it off to all the press, that's when Atari goes, oh, okay, we'd like a shot at publishing it. So it's kind of almost done when we found a publisher.
That's half the battle.
That's the weird thing. And it was good at the time. The guys at Atari who were there at the time were really keen on trying new stuff. And they were just keen to get behind it and try something, which a lot of other publishers weren't. We had people come back going, yeah, no, it's not dark and gritty enough. You still get the thing with publishers that they go, there's too much color in it. It's
like, oh yeah, like wipe over a bunch of brown on it. Yeah, like
yeah.
All the other first person shooters.
She's not a beige space marine as well.
Jesus, it's like you hear a little bit of insight. I used to be a bigger gamer than I am now, and it's like, no, not enough, too much color. Come on, you can't have a female protagonist? What? This just sounds ridiculous.
People are like, it won't sell. And to be honest, the game didn't sell that well, but that's part of it's down to people expecting something different of it. I think they were expecting something called Blade Kid to have a lot more, be like a Street Fighter game more than a platformer.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, like doing the game, it's like, okay, I want to make a game that's a bit like Strider. I want it to be about free-flowing exploration. I want to be able to walk around, jump up on walls, climb around stuff. I want it to be like find your way up to this cool corner and you find some treasure and you collect stuff. And the combat was basically about 80% cannon fodder, and then the rest of the 20% would be like stuff that you actually, you know, that's the challenging combat or more challenging combat. But you read all the reviews and everyone's like, oh, well, the art style matches the comic perfectly, and like, it's this sort of the exploration stuff's fun, but the combat's really weak, so it's not a very good game. It's like, what?
Yeah, it's. I did end up buying it, and I have played with it. It does have a classic feel to it as far as platformer goes. I'm not gonna actually give you a full review, but I thought it was a decent game. I'm still kind of playing through it. I kind of got lost, and then I got distracted by Team Fortress 2 and Minecraft. But
that happens.
I thought it was a decent game. Obviously, with anything, you can point out this and that of it, but I think it's definitely worth a shot.
Problems. I mean, it's no game is ever perfect when you finish it. It's like you've got to go, look, we've got a deadline.
Right.
You can't spend any more time tweaking stuff. And there's some stuff that I made decisions on, and I thought, okay, look, there's times you want to experiment when you're doing game design, so just try something slightly different. And publisher will push back against you, saying, no, don't do that. So you usually have to, like, you might have this really cool idea that you know is probably going to work,
mm-hmm.
but the publisher says, oh, don't do that. It's a bit too different from what people are expecting. And sometimes they're right. You've got to do that. You've got to pull back. Like on Star Wars, we're always going, look, you can't go off and do crazy stuff because it's not Star Wars and people are expecting a certain thing. So with Blakin, it was always like, you know, I want to try telling the story like very quickly and not give away too much information and see if that works. And I wanted to try a combat that was very super simple that you didn't have to think about stuff. And I think, you know, some stuff works, some stuff doesn't work. Some stuff that people don't like is stuff that I specifically really, really wanted to have because that's what I wanted to see in any game. Mm-hmm. And some people like that and people don't like that. And it was weird with reviews. The weirdest stuff I found, and I've done a lot of games, but you get reviews, usually there's a flow of we like this and we don't like that. And it's usually pretty much the same stuff across the board with reviews. With Blakin, one review would say, I love the voice acting, I hate the graphic style. And another review would say, I hate the voice acting and I love the graphic style. One guy would like the easy combat and exploration. Someone else would hate the combat and hate the exploration and love the combat. It's like, wait, what? It was very confusing after it was finished. I was trying to work out what the actual people liked and didn't like.
Right.
It was always different per review. And it's a very odd thing. I was sort of dumbstruck. I'd be walking around the office going, why? Who likes what about it? It's like, who hates this and who likes that? So
was it, did you guys end up publishing it or did Atari end up publishing it later or picking it up or what happened there?
So we were going to publish it ourselves for the PlayStation Network. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. Atari came on board and said, we'd like you to do the Xbox and PC versions. So we sort of spent another 6 months finishing those versions off. And then we published, put it out in September 2010. 2010? Hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, that was sort of fun.
And it's also available on Steam, which is, you know, what I bought it on.
Yes, the Steam version's good. It's like it goes on sale every couple of months and you can get it for about $5.
Yeah.
And if people complain about it, paying $5 for a game and it not being what they dreamed of, it's like you can't win on that front. It's a great price, too.
Yeah, $5, $10 for this game? Yeah, I mean, if you're a fan of platformers, yeah, totally, I would say. If you don't like platformers, you're probably not going to like this game because it's a platformer. You know, that's just how it is.
If you want a first-person shooter that's sort of brown, it's like, this is not the game for you. But if you want a classic-style, Strider-esque explorer map with a sense of fun that's a bit silly, yeah, this is the kind of game you want. But even then, it's not even in some ways, it's not even a classic platformer. It's where it's not about, you know, trying to make it over a series of jumps and you fall into your death in a bottomless pit, which a lot of people are like expecting platformers to be, when in fact most of them weren't, or only the good ones were.
Right.
It is really about like exploring nooks and crannies and trying to get to spots, because just the whole aspect of being able to climb over the ceiling, climb everywhere, just changes the whole way you play the game. If you just run through the game and try to fight the guys, it's not it's a boring game. If you run through the game exploring and trying backtracking and find as much stuff as you can, it's a whole different kind of game altogether.
Right.
And that's the kind of that's the game I want people to play. But reviewers are expecting I've got to fight through this guy, and there's no Street Fighter combos to when you're attacking stuff. They're expecting a different thing.
Right.
That's okay. I mean, that's one thing you learn. Like, do you work for what you want to make or what people expect you to make? And either one has no guarantee of actually being a success, to be honest. You know, you still failed aiming at an audience.
Yeah, and on that note, we're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about your past.
Cool.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter at WebcomicBeacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail by calling 1-320-310-0922. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity and the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic news, tropes, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Let's see here. Your video game company is called Chrome Studios.
Yep.
And you did... Let me look at the... T.Y. the Tasmanian Tiger, I do recall seeing.
That's Ty.
Ty. Sorry. Ty.
Oh, thank you, the Tasmanian Tiger.
Yes. Is Chrome Studios still in business?
We are. We had a period about a month after Blade Kitten came out where we had to basically lay off everyone.
Wow.
I'm not going into too many details, but it's like publishers expect you to have big teams just sitting there waiting for you, for them, to make a decision about which game they want to publish with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing they ask is like, do you have the people ready? And yeah, you, for a long time we'd keep people on, but what basically happened was publishers would take too long to make decisions on stuff and you'd run out of money.
Right.
Mm. But Chrome still exists. We've still put out, it's maybe about 12, 15 people at the moment. It's a very small contract team as opposed to where we had 400 people full-time. It's a huge difference. But, yeah, we're still putting a couple of games out. We did some stuff for Microsoft. The last one we did is some guys were working on the Windows 7 phone version of Toy Soldiers Cold War.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you see any stuff for that, that's... the guy who actually was the lead programmer on that was the lead programmer on Ty as well, way, way back. But he's done some it's a pretty amazing looking phone game. If you look at it, it's like, this should be on a console. Well, technically it is, but the phone version looks amazing. Lots of 3D. And so, yeah, we've done some stuff with Microsoft still. A few other bits and pieces, small projects here and there, but nothing in the scale we had originally. But we're hanging in there. It's a tough climate to make games at the moment because the whole industry is changing in big ways. So it's sort of a matter of trying to stick around long enough to work out where it's heading.
That's
the sad part of the story, but we're still around.
Let's see here. Somebody told me about Blade Kitten before, and this is like, as soon as they published Blade Kitten, it killed the company, and it's like, well, now you got it. It's like, well, it was their own thing, you know? It wasn't...
Yeah, so. But the thing with Blade Kitten, there's a little stuff on the net about how we did Blade Kitten, and that was it. It's like, Blade Kitten was 15 people out of a company that had 400. The others were actually waiting for publisher projects. And they were sitting around, publishers were sort of paying for them. But publishers were expecting you to work on stuff.
Hmm.
Is that you?
I don't know what happened. I'm hearing some feedback.
Oh, it's the apartment next door. Someone's taking a shower or something.
Wow. <That's awful. laughs>
Because my desk is right up against the wall here. I always have to listen to them.
All right.
Sorry.
So some games that you... made in the past, I'm looking at this list here. Halloween Harry, Alien Carnage, that sounds somewhat familiar, actually.
Did you ever play PC Shareware games in the 90s? That was Apogee's first VGA game. It was like
Apogee!
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Apogee, wow.
You know, so that was my first published game. Back in 92, 93, I can't even remember how long ago. 92 or 3, 93. Sorry. Yes.
I want a Steam Apogee pack. That'd be awesome. You just buy all these old games and you play them. They're like, there's like 12 pixels on the screen. Awesome.
We had 320x200.
Right. Right. I mean,
and it scrolled. We had like multi-layer parallax with smooth scrolling.
Oh, parallaxing.
The guys who did the coding and the engine for it were one of the guys have been worked with for like 10 years, until he left to go to work in America. But they were the entire team was just a bunch of really smart. Well, we were all smart kids at the time, but like everyone's gone off to do other bigger, better things. But that first game was a platformer, so old school platformer with a guy running over the jetpack and a flamethrower.
that's all you need, killing
zombies.
That's all you need.
Well, it predated the whole zombie craze by about 15 years.
Yeah.
Now everything's zombies, but we did like, we need to kill lots of stuff. What do we kill? Zombies are good because they're already dead.
Yeah. It's monsters.
Can't go wrong with zombies if they're already dead.
Yeah. The things that are always okay for killing are monsters, aliens, zombies, and Nazis.
And of course, if you do Wolfenstein, you've got zombies, Nazis, and
there you go.
You have
a few other games on here. I'm just going to mention, just in case anyone listening is like, oh, I remember that game. You got Zombie Wars, Flight of the Amazon Queen, Pro Body Boarding.
Yeah, that was, we need money.
What is Pro Body Boarding?
You know what body boarding is? It's
not really.
Oh, well, it's like, what's the term that surfers use for body boarders? A gut sliding shark biscuit. It's basically you may know them better as boogie boards from the 70s.
Okay.
A foam board.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're scooted. So bodyboarding is the cool version of that. It's a short foam board. You hop on that with flippers. You catch a wave and you basically do tricks. The biggest world champion at the time was Mike Stewart. And a guy in Australia got the rights to use his likeness and name on a bodyboarding game. And he went all around Australia trying to find a team to work on it. And then he went to England to a game show. He talked to a guy there. He said, oh, you should talk to these guys in Brisbane. He came back to visit us and said, yeah. At the time, I was like, well, we're really about to shut up shop or we can take this gig. So I was like, okay, we'll trying to make a wave. No one's trying to make a real 3D wave at the time.
Right.
And I was like, there's a challenge there. Let's try doing it. And ironically, that guy was the best guy we'd ever worked with as far as publishers. He actually paid us on time every month as opposed to the big publishers who would hold on to the money for months. And then in 99, he goes, look, I like working with you guys. I've got the business side of stuff covered. You guys want to get together and form a new company? And we did. And that was how we formed Chrome Studios.
Awesome.
So, yeah, it was a kind of weird thing. It was just the right time. And then from that, we made Tiger, the Tasmanian Tiger as one of the first Chrome original IP, which I did the character design for and level layouts, art direction.
Was that on the PS2?
Yes, and the GameCube and the Xbox.
Oh, okay.
So that was weird. We spent a year working on that and then we trying to find a publisher. Just like we'd do demos and talk to people who were making games. In the early PS2 cycle, there weren't any platforming games at all.
Mm.
And we actually got as far as Electronic Arts, and they were quite interested in doing something with us. But they had four other titles that they were working on that were platforming games. Yeah, and Ty was the bottom of their list.
Oh.
But we were in the system.
Yeah.
But one by one, all the other games that they were working on just got cancelled, killed. Just dropped off. So we became number one on the list of platform games that EA was going to publish. And in 2002 we came out and actually did really, really well, which is surprising.
Yeah, you got two sequels out of it too.
Yep. It actually did. It was weird. After about the first year, it was one of these games that it wasn't a smash hit in one go, but it was just kept selling steadily every month.
Oh, that's cool.
By the time a year later, it's like, we sold how many? And most of the guys at EA didn't even realize that it had sold that much when they decided to do a sequel. But we almost got a movie deal out of it and a TV series thing going. But like a lot of the time, you get the options gets bought out,
right?
And then they just go nowhere,
right? But, yeah, that's a thing. You know, things get optioned all the time. But it's still cool to be optioned if nothing happens. But
the best bit was we were actually working with I've got sketches and designs from the guys who are working on the TV series version of Ty, which is weird because at first they start off and it was nothing like my Ty.
Oh, geez.
I got the stuff and I go, this isn't Ty. What's going on? This doesn't look anything like, it's like We're not talking just off-model. It's like things look totally different. So I actually had a phone call with guys going, can we make it look more like the game tie? Because that makes sense being a license of that tie, that it looks like tie. Yeah, the way Mickey Mouse looks like Mickey Mouse in anything. Like, he doesn't look like a totally different character.
Do you have some of those sketches saved somewhere?
Yeah, they're in my work PC. I've got like there's some character shots and some town stuff. I'm planning on actually putting them together into an Art of Tie book at some stage.
Oh, cool.
Because there's some great stuff. Like these guys were ex-Disney, Warner Brothers, the animators, and it was great fun chatting with them, because once we got past the their rationale at first was like, well, we just got told to do this, and when we get given these gigs, we just go off and start doing whatever we feel like first, and then we get pushed back, and we go, oh, okay, fine, that works for me. So let's go on and try starting going closer to the game look and see what you get from that. But there's some backgrounds and stuff which are like jaw-droppingly amazing. And even the stuff they did, even if it wasn't the Thai style, it's like, this is really cool stuff, but it's not Thai. It's a pity that didn't go ahead, but it was a fun experience. It was just so outside of what I'm used to.
That's probably what happened with Sonic the Hedgehog, yeah. Though they said okay, you know, and you look at Saturday morning Sonic the Hedgehog, he's like, that's not Sonic.
I know how it happens too. I mean,
yeah,
because at Chrome we had teams that were working on different projects, and what would happen, I think, a lot of the time is people would get assigned stuff and they just wouldn't bother looking at the source material ever. You know, they just go, they do what they think something was, and
so pretty much anything in Hollywood.
Starship Troopers.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, and I found out when I we gave those guys the task of doing a tie game, because I wanted to say, look, I want to do some other stuff. I've done 3 tie games. Yeah, I'll oversee this stuff, but I don't want to do the day-to-day stuff. Can you guys put together something for the game? And the weird thing was, it took me 4 or 5 goes of telling them, have you played the game yet? Have you played the game yet? They go, no. No, have you played the game yet? No. It's like, they're asking, what's Tie like? It's like, well, play the game. Play Tie 2, play the first 10 minutes of Tie 2, that'll give you a really good idea what the whole game's like. It just sets everything up perfectly. And it went on for about a month or two, and the guys just would not bother looking at it. And I just said, go play the game and don't come back to me until you play the game. In a nice way, because I'm a nice guy. But it was very much, you've got to go do this. And then the guy comes back going, oh, I get it now. It's like this. I'm going, see? It wasn't that hard.
So that's what source material's for.
Yeah, and I get the feeling that this is what happens most of the time. When you see something go really off the rails, a lot of times it's because people do not bother looking. The other side of it is when about 2005, we were talking to Vivendi about doing Spyro, the dragon. So we did a version of a PS2 version of Spyro, which is great because we're big Spyro fans. But the guys at the publisher side of stuff wanted to shake things up and change Spyro around a lot. So
yeah.
The game that came out, and all the fans going, well, it's very different about the Spyro. We like the story and all this stuff, but it doesn't really feel like Spyro. It was because the publisher didn't want it to be like the old Spyro. We were going to go in there going, hey, we want it to be like Spyro and all this stuff. Like, no, we don't want that stuff. We don't have this. We don't have that feature. We don't have that feature. Like, you've just gotten rid of everything that Spyro and I really loved about the game. It's like, yeah, we want more like World of Warcraft. We want all the bad guys to have names and stuff like mob drops. I'm like, okay, because you guys are playing Warcraft at the moment. You want Spyro to be more like Warcraft. And it's like, fine. And sometimes sometimes it's the guys on teams don't look at stuff. Sometimes the publishers just want to change things around. And with a lot in mind, when I was doing Star Wars, I was like, no, I'm making Star Wars that's like the movies that I loved as a kid. I want that Star Wars because, you know, luckily it was actually set between the 3rd and 4th film. So I was like, it was getting it from pretend Star Wars to the real Star Wars movies. And I'm like, this has to... Oh, well, that's what I call
them. I like that. It's true.
Yeah.
And because the other thing was, like, it had Darth Vader in it, so I actually got to set up sequences for Darth Vader and pick out which lines I wanted and how does Darth Vader fight? You know, he's got to move fast, but it's going to feel like Star Wars. So for me, it was like, a huge Star Wars fan doing a Star Wars game, it's going to feel like Star Wars, down to the way we do the wipes, transitioning scenes down to Darth Vader walks like Darth Vader. He's got real weight to him. He doesn't fly around doing crazy shit. And it was all stuff like, how do you work all that stuff out? When we got to do it, the cool thing was when you play Vader at the beginning and you play the apprentice later on, and it, because it's that unleashed stuff later on, there's this really good contrast between, you know, this is what you expect Star Wars to be, and then here's what we're changing with Force Unleashed and Unleashing the Force. So it had that really great, you know, just transition there. But it was very much, we're doing Star Wars like Star Wars. We're looking at all the reference stuff, making the vehicles look right, making the feel look right. Yeah, I think one of the cinematic sequences one of our guys did had the slow motion shot, like a bullet time thing. I said, get rid of that. That's not Star Wars. There's no slow motion in Star Wars. That's not how George directed the film. So it was down to doing stuff like that. But yeah, a lot of people, I don't think, look at stuff and they'll just put whatever, you know, whatever's cool and they like, and they'll try to wedge that into whatever license they're doing. I don't even know how we get to that point and talk about licensing stuff. What was the question?
I don't know.
What year is this? Who's the president?
I don't know. It won't matter in like 11 months anyway. So,
So I have a question about the comic, actually.
There's a comic? Cool.
Something like that on there. On average, how long? Because this artwork looks pretty detailed. It looks pretty intricate. How long on average does it take to do a page?
It depends. I've gone from like, sometimes you'll do a page in about, I'd say about a day, a good 8 hours is a reasonable time for a page, fully colored, finished. But I've had pages that will take, they just struggle to come out. They're like these long labor birth things that go on for days. And yeah, the face will never work right. It's like, it's just this eyeball is not sitting properly, or you're trying to ink it and you just cannot get into it. And they can take I've had 2 or 3 days on some pages. And the new story I'm doing, the Dirty Justice one, because I wanted to have a different feel and try some new stuff, and I really wanted to push myself by doing background. Honestly, it was 3 days for some pages, 4 days, where it would be like just trying to get the inking perfect and the background's working. And then you realize it's going to be shrunk down to like 800 by 600. And people are going to look at it, and they're not going to see any of those little mistakes. Like, I would get really anal about inking lines. Like, if there's a little one pixel smidge over a line, I would actually go through and clean everything up.
I have a friend that does that too. It's like she's like, look, she like zooms in like to these little grass blades. Like, nobody's going to notice that.
I know, because I start off doing pixel art, so everything you do, like, was be zoomed in ridiculously, so you'd be doing pixel by pixel, because a pixel would make a difference on a yeah, on a little sprite. One pixel could be an eye or a mouth, depending on like where you put it. So I'm always still in that mindset. You're trying to get out of that, going, no one's gonna notice. I can roughen up a little bit and be a little bit looser. So yeah, on the second issue, well, the second batch of pages, which will be an issue two, like I'm loosening up. It's like, okay, look, I don't have to worry about that so much. Relax here. Don't struggle there. Mm-hmm. And it's gone from like 3 days a page down to about a day and a half, I'd say, just doing a page now.
This is all digital, right? Or are you doing it on paper at all? Or
I've had a Cintiq since 2005, like a 21-inch one.
Oh.
I haven't had paper drawn on paper, God, in about 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
And this, just 2 months ago, November, I bought the new 24 HD Cintiq, which, oh my God, it is the most amazing thing. The original one was a 21 HD. It was beautiful. It was great. It was the best thing to draw on. I love that thing. I'd live on it. But the new one, it's like, how did I get it better? It was like, it's just, it picks up the detail better. The screen feels good. It's sturdier. It's got more features.
Did you have to buy a whole new table to put it on? Or
I did not realize how big it is.
Yeah.
Because it's 24 inches of like the screen size. But then, it's going to have a good 5-6 inches on that around the outside. And then a huge base. So it's really sturdy. And like, it takes up twice the size of the other one did. So yeah, wow. But then again, my table is basically, this thing is the centerpiece of my, I don't have a large trestle table too. I've got plenty of desk space, even though it's filled with crap. But yeah,
of course.
The oh, it has to be. It's like I still have piles of paper. I don't even draw on paper, but it's like just stuff stacked up, comic books, tubs full of pens that I haven't used in ages.
I got huge stacks of sticky notes that I have no idea what they are. But they were important at one point, but.
Yeah, you get those. I had that on my, when I worked, that's what my monitor was like. I had these notes all over them. Like, you'd write, you'd be working on the game. It's like, oh, fix this thing up. So I'd have sticky notes stuck down so I'd remember all those bits and pieces. You just hand them to people. Okay, you take care of that, take care of that. But, yeah, no, I love working digitally. I love undo. I love being able to rotate the screen. I love having the. With digital, you can experiment more. You don't feel so bound by, oh, I'm going to make a mistake when I'm inking. You take chances digitally. You're not scared of, like, I'll try doing this. You know, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, there's undo. And when you're working on Cintiq too, it's like, well, you're drawing on a screen. So you're not, it's not that kind of normal tablet thing where you're sort of looking in. And I've been using tablets for nearly 20 years. No, not 20 years. 15 years? 16 years? Mm. Like I had one of the first big Wacom, an A4 one, which was, it says it was an A4 tablet, but it was the size of a large monitor. And I used this little tiny screen bit in the middle. But yeah, even though being used to that stuff, drawing on the screen, actually looking at what you're drawing at and having the response come up quickly and be able to zoom it, do more detail or zoom it out, have other screens you cut and paste between. It really just, I don't know, I just find it really fast to work. And like I said, you try stuff. You're like, oh, I want to try this color. No, that worked. No, it didn't work. Okay, it takes that, get rid of that. Panel layout, changing stuff, or going, okay, that head's totally wrong. Let's zoom that up and scale it and move it around. And so I use the Photoshop side of Photoshop as well. It's like, when you do it on pencils, like you get there, you get it wrong, you've got to erase it all or cut, or the old days, you'd stick stuff on top. You know, you cut a whole panel out of a page and replace it. So if you look at old artwork, it's like these sheets of Bristol paper, and then there'd be like a whole panel cut out stuck on top. Or where you surgically remove the panel, put the new one in place, and then tape it up so it's the same level. Now it's like, yeah, just move that around. That character needs to be half an inch to the left. Move it that way. I love doing that. It's very George Lucas-y.
Yeah.
You know, let's just put him a little to the left.
Yeah, when I started with making my own webcomic, I had used trace paper for the inking because I didn't want to erase my sketches.
I did that too.
My sketches always looked so great. And then it's like, then I could cheat with, I could rotate the trace paper. It's like, I want the arm up here. Or this is before I learned
how totally
to draw.
I totally did the same thing when I was doing stuff. I have all these comics. I used to spray paint them white on the back after I was finished as well. So they look like not like tracing paper, but they have a nice white back on it. So just a little white spray paint. And the other one I used was, there was like a tracing vellum stuff you use for a drafting film.
Oh, yeah.
That was terrible to ink on. It was so smooth. You'd try and ink it, and everything would just slip everywhere. And the ink would pool up. So it was nice solid paper, but like the tracing paper that, over stuff, yeah, I used to use that all the time. I would color on it too. You color on the back with just your what do you guys call them? I used to use Letraset pens and stuff. So you ink on one side and flip it over, and you color on the back, like kind of like a cell, but it would mute the colors down a little bit. But it's like perfect inks and color behind it. So yeah, all this stuff I had to mess around with. That's why I was so happy to jump in and go fully digital. It's like, I don't have to worry about that now. It's layers. Yeah, color layers.
For me, because I wanted to do the old-timey thing with the crow quills, right? I could never figure out the brush and still can't. But I sucked so bad at both of them. And what I would have to do is I'd make a mistake. So I'd have to go in and I'd get some white out.
Yep.
Put it on there. Wait for it to dry. Then you have to draw over it again. And now you have a defect in the surface of the paper. It's not smooth anymore. So you make another mistake and you got it.
Yep. And then you're fixing it up. Oh, I remember that so bad.
Hated it. So yeah. I'm very happy with my Wacom, even though it's not a new one. It's
they're still awesome. They're like my first tablet ever was an Atari 800. they had a wide tablet. And the mid-80s, and the stylus had a little cable on it, a little button, and you'd draw on it. So I've been using like tablets since forever. But yeah, they're the best thing. If anyone out there wants to draw comics, go buy a tablet.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So it's, and learn to draw that. You'll get used to looking at the screen while you're drawing it, but there are people who can use a mouse. I don't understand how they.
Yeah, they're, you know, it, see, well, that's what I always, whenever I do, I have a crash course to webcomics presentation that I do at conventions that I go to. And yep. I always caution people that, you know, getting, you know, stock card paper is not going to make you a better artist. Using Prismacolor markers are not going to make you a better artist. Getting a Wacom is not going to make you a better artist. An artist is going to be a, you know, these are tools. And how an artist uses their tools is what's most important. They don't magically make... There's a learning curve for every tool. That's the thing.
Exactly. But some tools make it easy to get stuff done. Once you know, if you know the basics and how to draw properly and all that, those elements, you still have to know all that stuff.
Yeah. Though I will say...
But you need the foundation.
Exactly.
You can't build without the foundation.
I will say, if you're going to be coloring digitally, I don't... It's like, honestly, if you're going to be even semi-serious about... doing a webcomic or a comic in general and you want to color digitally, get at least the cheapest bamboo tablet from Wacom because coloring digitally is a lot easier than drawing as far as like the hand to eye from the screen, and is so much better than that mouse. Oh my goodness.
Damn straight. I actually got put onto a really cool plugin for coloring that's like a, I'm guessing a lot of the pro guys use just doing normal coloring. What's it called?
B-Pelt,
yeah. I just started using that recently. Like, that's cut down the boring part of coloring by about 90% of the time. Like, flatting in the colors originally, like, even the quickest way would just be, oh, my God, this is boring. You get to that point, it's like, I don't want to color it, but that's the fun bit. And now with B-Pelt, it's like, yep, okay, ready to start coloring stuff. That's worth the money on that one. So I think I started using it a month ago, but now I would never give it up.
It makes it a lot easier. But we got to take our last break, and when we come back, we'll wrap things up. That was Dwagon Hugs off of Star Road by Kitsune Squared, found at lapfoxtracks.com. Well, this show's going a lot longer than I thought it was, so I and that's fine. We got a lot of you know a lot more stuff than I thought you knew, so that's good.
Oh, I've been around a long time.
I noticed you're like putting in texture as well. Right? I mean, it looks like on some of the buildings and things, you're using a texture transparency or something in there.
There's a brush that gives a nice texture to it when you scribble it on, and you get some good effects with it.
Okay, I haven't tried that.
It's like it's got a noise texture through it, and it's basically a little square brush, so you rub it across. And you can do stuff like if you put it through with one color, like a dark gray, there's like just a multiplier layer.
Mm-hmm.
You get the texture, but if you then switch to white and draw over the same area with different pressure, it uses the same texture and puts it back, so you get this kind of cool shape that looks like cement sort of stuff to it.
Oh,
it's because you get that, it'll then take the white bit out. So where it was getting darker originally, it'll cut back to white. So then you have dark bits and then they get to white. And it's, I found it by accident when I was just messing around with it. It's like, oh, if you do that, oh, that's a really good effect. So I use that a lot. And it's kind of my sort of key texture effect I use on Blade Kit. And we ended up using the game as well a lot to get that feel of, this is what we have, what the texture we're going to use is. So it's not really, it's not really a well thought out texture, but it gives you a bit of noise. It's not just noise or cloud texture.
I have to play with that. I don't use the multiply. I never seem to use that, or I haven't figured it out yet. Well, I usually just go with an extra layer or something.
Well, I use multiply for the shading on it. Like, I'll do a color pass, so it's just flat colors, and then I'll do the one pass, which is, you know, just a multiply to get the tones. For the, because I obviously like the anime look, so I want to get that kind of 2-3 tones in there. And then I'll use a dodge for the highlights. And if I want really white stuff, I'll go to I can't remember the term of it. Not additive.
It's like a mask or a, is it a mask?
No, the correct term for it is screen, which is an additive.
Like a halftone. As
opposed to, no, it's basically screen. It's just, it's like there's light and screen is the Photoshop layer. Basically, it just takes the stuff and brightens it up. But it goes, whereas a dodge will go through the color, screen will sort of go through to white and actually bring everything up. But dodge won't touch black. If there's no color in it, like a black, dodge won't touch it. So you get weird black lines, but a screen will bring everything up. Sort of, it's kind of just lightens everything.
There's so much to learn in Photoshop, and
yeah.
I mean, even without an upgrade, you could spend your whole life learning all the tricks. And
yeah,
then they go and release the next scene,
and then they screw it up. We can talk about Adobe.
They release CS4 and screw it up, and then CS5 fixed everything,
and then screw up other things that were fine that from CS3. Anyway,
yeah, that was weird. I had we'd be using four. It's like, Where'd that feature go? And then CS5 brought everything back. It's like, oh, there it is again. Oh, I'm so happy.
Did we? Oh,
and 5 brought the speed back. I was happy with that as well, because 4 was like, why is it running like a dog now? I'm just trying to draw. And then 5's like, my God, it's like CS3 all over again. Whee!
Did we talk about your other comic, Kitty Kazawa, Freelance Exorcist?
Just now you have?
Because I found that clicking through some stuff and it's like, wait, you didn't mention this yet, did you?
No, we haven't talked about that one. So Kitty Kazawa is just this weird weird demon hunting, just weirdness, basically. It's I'm a little lost for words. The tagline is, it's like, it's the story of a girl, her guns, and the demons in her life. And it's quite literally there. She lives with some demons. Like, her apartment in this trendy suburb of Tokyo is one of the sort of substations of purgatory, where things go if they've been. So she's sort of hanging out, taking care of these demons, while she works these really dumb jobs part time, and then working as an exorcist. And there's also these other factions that run around that she bumps into doing stuff. And literally every story is like, it's some weird idea that I'll do as a short story. And every time I've got another idea for one, I'll do one. But then it'll go for like a year or two without doing another one. Then I'll do another short story. And so far, I think I've hit about 70 pages of short stories, which I just put together in a book.
Okay.
But yeah, it's all about being silly and just black and white comics too. So whereas Bacon's full color, well, I didn't start out that way. Kitty, because I was like, I'm just going to do black and white comics. I wanted to keep it really simple, so, you know. And that one too has gone from like, oh, here's a short 6-page story, to the last one was about 30 pages, I think. they grow like that. But when I started doing Blade Kitten, the point was like, I'll do it in black and white. So originally Blade Kitten starts off as a black and white comic, and I was doing it really quickly. I thought, oh, well, this is really easy doing the black and white stuff. You know, it shouldn't be that much harder to just make it in color. Famous last words. Once you go to color, just there's so much more to think about. Like, oh, the lighting's going to be different now, and you can't just make that light gray and that dark gray. It's like, this is going to be this color, and it's going to have shading on it. So that blew out of all proportions. But yeah, Kitty Kazawa has been these simple, fun, silly short stories, as I think of them.
Very nice.
Alrighty. I also noticed that you have a store here. Am I recording? Yes, I'm recording. Okay. You actually have a soundtrack for Blade Kitten available that I noticed.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things we put out. Because my brother actually does the music for Blade Kitten and the sound. Keep it all in the family. But, he released that last year, I think. No, it wasn't here before. It was last year. And that's available for the Blade Kitten site.
It's on iTunes, though, so that means I don't get it because I don't use iTunes. I refuse to use iTunes.
There are other links for it, too. I don't know I didn't actually put them on the website, but you can get it from CD Baby and Amazon as well, I think.
All right, well, that's fine. I just don't like using iTunes. I just got a bug up my butt about it.
No, that's straight up. That's why it's on a whole bunch of different sites. If you look around, you'll probably find it.
Okay.
But iTunes is the easy one for most people, so I just stuck that one up on the site.
Okay. And you do have the comics, at least up until now, available.
Yeah. I've just actually updated my other website, spacecaptainsteve.com, and the store up there has got all the whole bunch of stuff, like T-shirts and the collections. Like, you get these hardcover ones now at Blurb, and I did those as a test. Like, oh, let's see what this looks like. And like, they came through like, oh, wow, these are really nice. They're kind of the smaller digest-sized comics as opposed to comic book size. And having a 160-page hardcover comic is like the most awesome thing ever.
Is that black and white or color?
Full color. The black and white one I did was 76 pages. Like, I did Kitty Kizaru in like a little hardcover version as well. And it's, an option for like nice paper or the crappier paper, the sort of the cheap print paper you get on a hardcover book. And I tried that on. It's like, it looks really cool because they've got a faux leather cover look on the front. And then you open it up. It's like, oh, this is yellow pages. And it looks really stylistically awesome. Like, but it's just sort of, it's the cheap option.
Oh. So is that a print on demand outfit?
Yeah. Blurb does a lot of photo books and stuff. They've got a really simple site. If you ever want to put your comics together, they can do like, they can do the trade paperback style, square bound, but they don't have a proper comic size in most things. So I tried their normal books as the digest size, which is sort of like the manga size comics, but a little bit bigger. Same aspect ratio roughly as comics, any comics. And they got the softest way. Plop, it took me about an evening to set up the comics and then put a book together and get it ready to print. And they came back in about 2 weeks. Quality is pretty good. Price is expensive doing stuff that way. Like for hardcover, it's
well. The profit margin is a lot lower for a print on demand, of course.
Definitely, it's good if you want to do small runs and just try stuff out. Like I did a bunch as presents for Christmas. And yeah, so it's nice. You have a nice hardcover art-off book, just to family members and stuff, in case the apocalypse comes.
Yeah, I noticed on the Blurb site, it actually can give people the option if they want a soft cover, hard cover with a dust jacket or whatever, and there's different prices there. And it's like, hey, that's a really cool option to have if somebody really wants a hard cover.
Yeah, you can go for like, it's more expensive. You can change the paper on it. You can decide, there's three options for covers, soft cover, dust jacket, and a case image wrap, which is, that's that kind of... the ones where the cover is the picture as opposed to the... Yeah, and I actually like go for those. But the soft cover prices actually worked out pretty decently. And like I said, the quality is good. You can go for the... If you want, if you think you're really going to like it, you can spend the extra and get the good paper. And the choice goes down to the... Here's where it gets a bit wanky sounding. The choice is down to the consumer. It's like if you want to... if you think, I really like Steve's stuff and I want to have it for a long time, you can buy the nice one. We go, look, I like Steve's stuff, but I don't want to blow an extra $20 on pretty paper. So I go with the one that's still good, but not expensive.
Yeah.
So I said, I did it just as a tryout. It's like, I'll try these guys out, see what this is like and if it's any good. And then when I got the copies, I was like, I'm going to put this on my store. This is worth selling. Yeah, not just for myself, but actually making it available. So I did an art-off book and everything.
Wow.
Well, it's more like a sketchbook for this year, but I call it my art of book. It sounds more impressive. It is my art of book. Well, there featuring my art ofs.
Yes. Let's see here. I don't think there's really all that much to mention. I was planning to talk about some other video games that have been based off of webcomics. But I decided to save that for another episode. And also, since people are listening to this, if you know of any such games based off of webcomics, go ahead, send an email to us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com, and we will set up another episode this year after we find some and try them out and whatnot and see how that goes. Some additional news I want to say here. Tanya, co-host from the beginning of the Webcomic Beacon, all the way from 216 episodes ago in 2007, there from the beginning, she's going to be stepping down as co-host. She just has... she has just other stuff that she needs to do, and that's fine. So it sounds like I'm going to have to be vetting for a new female co-host for the Webcomic Beacon. I have no idea how I'm going to do that. I don't know, putting it out there, I have no idea. We'll see. But it's sad. But at least I still have the PenguinCon video of all of us together and me frustrating Tanya to hell and back. But
I think it was the other way around.
I'm glad I recorded that video. It was great. So that's about that. Let's see here. I don't know what other news that we got. We do got a show coming up for next week. If you go to webcastbeacon.com/calendar, you should be able to see what sort of programming we have coming down the line. Webcomic Beacon shows might be a little iffy for now as far as getting the scheduling out there. So just keep an eye on there. For things coming up, I believe we're supposed to have Peter Minotti from Evil Diva on next week. So stay tuned for that. And from thereafter, on February 12th, we're gonna have the guy from the Gates comic and heavy metal, the heavy metal website on the show. We're gonna be basically talking about heavy metal. You remember heavy metal from the 80s and. You know, when it was
hair really and
yes, yeah. And the movie. There we go. We're going to be having him on next month. He does the first heavy metal web comic, basically.
Ooh,
so
cool.
So that'll be it. As far as other things, I have no idea what else to say here. I probably should have written down more notes. But, so anyway, yes, for people that may have noticed, the Webcomic Beacon newscast is now blended into the Webcomic Beacon feed, because the Webcomic Beacon newscast feed apparently wasn't working, and people thought we weren't doing it anymore, or some people did. But it's good information that this audience should be led in on, and it's a lot easier just as one feed instead of two feeds, so there you go. And that is about it for this show. I would like to thank, Space Captain Steve for coming on.
It's been a pleasure.
And,
thank you.
And yes, thank you very much for coming on. And you have websites at spacecaptainsteve.com, bladekitten.com, and kittykazawa.com. And, you know, all of this stuff. I'll get it all in the show notes, including the link to the video games. You guys can check it out. If you like platformers, if it's like $5-$10, easily just grab it.
Or two or three copies. Before.
Yeah, buy it for your friends. There you go. So I will let Space Captain Steve get to bed since it's like 5 in the morning there.
It's just in time for the sun to rise.
Oh, no. So, well, anyway, I have been Fess of ArdraComic.com.
And this is Mark of AutumnLake.com.
And I'm Space Captain Steve, signing off. Faltadan. F-A-L-T-E-R-D-A-N.
Is that a swear word or an actual character in your in the comic?
It's a swear word in the comic.
Okay, wasn't
it? Is. It's funny because there's a line in Empire Strikes Back when Luke's crashing into Dagobah, and he goes, "The line is actually all the scopes are down. I can't see a thing." And for like 20 years, I thought it said, "All this Faltadan, I can't see a thing," because there's the swear word in Battlestar Galactica, which is was it Feldekarb?
Feldekarb.
Same sort of. Yeah, it's the same sort of thing. So I just thought, oh, that's a Star Wars swear word.